Podcast. In conversation with musicians from the UK jazz scene. And now your hosts, Rob Cope and Dan Farrant.
Hello and welcome to episode 28 of the Jazz Podcast. This is Dan. I'm sadly not joined today by Rob, which is a shame. But we are joined by Mr. Liam Noble, who Rob sat down with a few weeks ago to chat about his career, what he's been up to, music, jazz. Let's just press play and get right to it.
Aha.
Ah, good. It's working.
It sounds beautiful.
Excellent.
Liam Noble, welcome to the Jazz Podcast.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, thanks for making the time to come on our glorious experiment. So, let's talk about your life. Where did you grow up?
Well, I guess I'm not grown up yet, really, but
I was just thinking.
In terms of, yeah, where I spent my childhood, it was actually in Bromley in Kent.
Right.
So I think for the first 3 or 4 years, I lived in Chiswick, and then we moved to Bromley, to the suburbs.
Yeah.
Glorious suburbs. And, yeah, so that's where I was.
Is that out, like, on the district line? In the east?
Oh, no. Well, that's further out than Bow. I'm talking about Bromley in Kent.
Right. Actual. Like,
shoe shops, the whole bit.
Cool.
You know. Well, mostly shoe shops, not the whole bit, just the shoe shops.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
What did your parents do?
Well, my dad, I remember, used to work as a sales rep for a net curtain company called Gardiset. And I remember he used to get a free estate car every year, which he used to then have to fill with net curtains and a stand to put them on, which had wheels, which meant that me and my brother could use it as a sort of makeshift skateboard and go down the middle of the street.
That sounds great.
Yeah, it was a little bit dangerous. It was a bit like going on a shopping trolley. You know? Like wheels that spin on their own axis.
Yeah.
And a big frame. Like you see clothes hung on in a shop, you know. It's like going down the middle of the road on one of those.
Nice.
Except because we were in Bromley, it wasn't too busy. This was the benefit of the suburbs, you see.
Yeah.
So anyway, getting back to wherever we were. So my dad, he worked for a net curtain company. And then I think there was a time where he had a friend who had an antique shop and this guy sold oak antiques, and they were very expensive. And my dad happened to notice that a church was getting rid of all its pews, just throwing them out. So he got them for nothing and sort of did them up and sold them for a lot of money. I think that's how it worked. And he basically fitted out a pub with these pews. I don't know how he did it. You know, I don't know what expertise he had. But anyway, from then on, he started working for himself, doing sort of reproduction pine mirrors. And in the 80s, when pine was a big thing, it was like everybody's house was just yellowy pine stuff everywhere. So that's what he did most of the time. And my mum, when she was working, worked as a medical secretary. So she used to answer the phones of people and say, "I'm sorry, your operation's been postponed."
Yeah.
For a living.
Wow, that sounds like a hard job. Like nobody likes you when you're doing that, I'm sure.
Yeah, that's true. I guess. I'll have to ask her about that, actually.
I guess it depends on the quality of the people, you know, the speed of the surgeons and what have you that she was working for, you know.
Yeah, it depends how quickly they could get through a round of golf, I think. Back to emergency surgery.
Yeah.
But this is a broad generalisation for any consultants or surgeons listening to this programmer, which I'm sure there'll be many.
There are. We're pretty... Actually, you know, I don't know about the surgeons, but right now we're having an outstanding run in Tokyo. I know.
Wow.
I don't know why, but Tokyo's been our top city for several weeks and is currently tied exactly with London for the number of plays we've had.
Wow.
Super weird.
Tokyo's on my bucket list for places to play or go. I've actually been once, but if anyone from Tokyo's listening can pay my flight, I'll come over and clean your bathroom and play music.
Oh, great. We can definitely, the way this is going at the moment, I'm sure there's loads of people now Googling you and looking at ways to get you over for the ultimate bathroom clean.
Yeah, absolutely. One lives in hope.
When did you go?
Now, let me think. Would have been about 4 years ago.
Oh, not that long ago.
It was an experimental music festival.
Yeah.
But it was... I mean, this is one of the reasons why I want to go to Tokyo. It was like a festival of pretty much unlistenable, to the most part, music. You know, most people would say that isn't music to what was going on. But this place was massive. It was like a sort of several aircraft hangars put together, all these movable stages on wheels. There were robots playing real instruments as a band. It was the whole thing was weird. There was a Buddhist nun that sat on a chair and talked for an hour and a half, and then there was a band with 100 drummers. And I mean, it was
wow.
It was pretty insane. And I was doing this sort of improvised music and poetry thing with this guy Penny Rambo, who was a singer with a band called Crass in the late 70s, early 80s, I think.
Yeah,
a sort of punk, I suppose. If he's listening, I'm sure he'll be pointing out my generalizations, but it was kind of anarchist, sort of punk, kind of burning money sort of type band.
Yeah. So,
and now he does sort of poetry readings with improvised stuff, which is great fun.
Yeah. That's how did it go down at the festival?
Well, actually, it was pretty amazing. The other thing that was amazing about it is that these places were full. The gigs were like rammed with people, young people, not beard scratching kind of 60s rebels who are still convincing themselves that avant-garde music is important. It was like, yeah. It was young people half my age, you know.
Yeah.
That is young, just by the way. Half of 48 is 24.
Cool. Yeah.
That must be about your age, right?
I'm 29.
Oh, blimey.
I know. Man, when I studied what feels like yesterday, but it was a really long time ago already.
Yeah.
Which is disturbing.
Cracky.
Mm-hmm. I know. So how did you first get into the piano?
Well, I don't know how far back to go with this, really. There's one sort of apocryphal story of me when I was 2 years old in the car, as told by my nan, my dad's mother.
Yeah.
We were all in this car driving and the radio was on. And for some reason, my dad turned the radio off and I started crying. And my nan said, oh, he's going to be into music, that one. Or he loves his music.
Wow.
So, and my granddad on my mum's side had a grand piano in his house.
Yeah.
I was brought up to believe that he was a concert pianist.
Yeah.
I don't know what a pianist is to this day. I don't know if they exist anymore. But he clearly wasn't a concert pianist, but he had a lot of Chopin. And I used to just sit and pick tunes out on this piano, mainly because I was absolutely bored to death at my granddad's house where you couldn't knock anything over or
make
any mess, or it was one of those things. So I I just used to sit on this piano picking tunes out, and then I started having lessons after that, really.
Oh, wow.
And
That's such a prophetic thing for a grandma to say when you're two, you know. Oh, he's going to be an improvising pianist, that one.
Well, I think, yeah, it was more like he's happy when the music's on.
Yeah.
And I would say, broadly speaking, I haven't really got any further on in my development from that. And you said, where did you grow up? That's why I thought, not sure. It's work in progress, really. Yeah.
That. Nobody's ever thought about that answer so much as you. That was fantastic. and then, so can you, was there a point when you were growing up when you were like, this is definitely what I'm going to do with my life? Or did it just kind of keep unfolding, you know, one step at a time?
Yeah, it was an unfolding thing, really. I mean, I think, I don't know whether I would think this now about music, but in those kind of pre-internet vinyl days, you know, even before cassettes, maybe cassettes were around, but I'm just trying to think. I always thought I would do something with the piano. People were always telling me I was good at it. You know, I did all my grades super quick and, you know, so there was this thing of, you're going to be a pianist. And for me, it was like, if you're good enough, then people will ask you to play the piano and that's what you will do. I didn't have any concept of career strategy or back or mailing lists or anything, you know, because it was just my perception of it was, if you're good enough, you can do it.
Yeah.
And sort of dropping that facade has been the most painful thing about being a musician, I think.
Yeah.
You know, is that it isn't that simple.
No.
It's often violently more complicated and opposite than that. So
it's an obscenely complicated thing to do.
But I think I wanted to be a pianist. Then I sort of got a bit frustrated with classical music.
You did all of your classical grades?
Yeah.
So you were like classically trained to start with?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think I did my first four grades in 2 years or something. It was insane.
I don't know, people
were sort of obsessed with grades in those days.
Yeah.
And I got into jazz because my parents wanted me to play Scott Joplin. They liked, there was a film called The Sting that came out in the 70s and that had all music by Scott Joplin.
Oh, cool.
In it, and so it was, that music I think was quite famous in the 70s.
Yeah.
And there was a famous series of recordings by this guy Joshua Rifkin, and I had cassettes of all these recordings which I would play in my bedroom on my Pi single speaker cassette player.
Yeah.
And I suppose that was sort of my first way into jazz, because it sounded a bit like jazz.
Yeah.
And from there, I got interested in Jelly Roll Morton. And from there, got interested in Ellington.
Yeah.
My dad had the Ellington Louis Armstrong record done in the early 60s.
Yeah.
Which is still one of my favourite recordings ever, you know.
Yeah.
And so from Ellington, you kind of go to everything. I went to Bromley Library, which had quite a lot of jazz records. And I just got them all out. And among those, there was a lot of stuff like Ellington and Coltrane, Money Jungle, some kind of Sun Ra stuff, which I can't really remember, but loads and loads of things, Jerry Mulligan. So it sort of, it was quite a random process. Whatever was in the library, that's what I got into, you know.
Yours sounds like an incredibly neat and chronological start to have, like, you know, started with Joplin and then like worked your way forwards. That's the thing of beauty.
Yeah, I suppose it was. I mean, I did miss out a lot of the golden age, like 45 to 65, which I suppose is what people reckon to be the golden age of jazz. A lot of that stuff, I either missed it out or I didn't realize when I was listening to it that it was important.
Yeah.
So I had Art Blakey records, but I didn't understand where they fitted in history.
Yeah.
Quite a lot of the time, the things didn't have you know, albums, they would do sort of cheap vinyl releases where they didn't have details on the label. So I didn't know it was recorded, you know. So you just pick it up and you think, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Piano player's not playing down the bottom anymore. Oh, well, you know.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I think I always was really into early pre-bebop stuff.
Yeah.
And I kind of got into the freer stuff via that, really. So I was really into Bud Powell, but for me, Bud Powell that I liked was the sort of solo stuff, the sort of, it wasn't the bebop changes kind of thing.
Yeah.
And Charlie Parker, it took me ages to get to Charlie Parker.
Yeah.
And I got to him because that was the first, I think he was the first musician where I thought, okay, everyone says he's really good, I better get some.
Yeah.
You know, and like most people, I didn't get it at first. It seemed frenetic and kind of difficult, and which of course now I know is the benchmark of jazz. So yeah, it was sort of neat, but only the early bit. Then after Ellington, you kind of, it's quite easy to skip things.
Yeah.
And of course I got into Miles, and I went quite chronologically through Miles according to Ian Carr's book, you know.
Oh, cool.
I bought a lot of the albums that he thought were great.
Yeah.
And then missed out some of the really great albums that he didn't rate, you know.
So. Yeah.
But it was, you know, the thing about doing that is you get into one person's play. So Miles as a player and as a band leader and kind of composer and a sort of conceptual musician, it's like getting into Stravinsky, who I was also really into. It was like, what did they do next? It wasn't like, what was the history of the whole music?
Yeah.
You know, all these people seemed quite separate to me. Like Mingus didn't seem to have much to do with Coltrane, as far as I could tell. And, you know, and Sonny Rollins is something else. Again, it's that they seem to be evolving separately to me, not according to the history of the music, which is taught, which is, I mean, it's also valuable. It's just not the way that I perceived it when I was getting into it.
Yeah. So was there a time, because I remember one for myself distinctly where, like, the change happened from being classically trained to knowing I would play jazz forever. Yeah. Do you remember having that?
Not really. It was a lot more of an overlap, I think. I slowly started spending more time playing jazz than I did. I remember this tune, Tour de Force, which is a Dizzy Gillespie tune or Sonny Rollins tune? It was on a Dizzy Gillespie record with Sonny Stitt.
Right.
I took down the changes, which probably were wrong at the time. I mean, I don't know how old I was, 14 or 15.
Yeah.
And I remember getting down one set of voicings and then just playing this tune for ages and ages and ages. Just like, it wasn't really structured improvising. I wasn't practicing arpeggios. I wasn't doing it. I was just trying to play things on it. And
yeah.
Play sort of half an hour, and occasionally I would tape myself, and somebody's got a tape. I there was a guy who played saxophone in the Lewisham concert band called Colin. I can't remember his second name, but I think I gave him a tape because he was already playing a bit of jazz.
Yeah.
Gave him a tape of this stuff. So maybe I was 16, 15, 16. And yeah, I remember him listening to it and saying, oh, you know, you sound really good. Just keep doing what you're doing. But I don't think I ever got the cassette back. But I'd be interested to hear it.
Now. Yeah, it must be in the world somewhere.
Yeah.
Did you study at college?
Yeah, well, I did a music degree at Oxford, but it was classical music. So it wasn't playing. It was an academic, essays, composition, counterpoint, parody composition, which is like doing Bach fugues and Balestrina counterpoint and all that stuff.
That sounds well hard.
But I used to really enjoy it. It was really satisfying.
Yeah.
I had a freedom to do what I wanted to do there. It was like when you had tutorials that were one-on-one, really, or two-on-one, two students, one tutor.
Yeah.
And they would say something like, okay, this week we're going to do, I want you to talk about Sibelius. That was kind of it. So in a way, you know, if you said that to somebody now, they would scribble a paragraph on a bit of paper and try and get away with handing it in. And then if you mark it too low, they'd try and complain and sue you or something. But in those days, it's like, okay, I need to write a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
About Sibelius, whatever I like, but it has to be a lot of work. And what I used to do is just get scores out and go over it with a pencil and sort of analyze what was happening in the scores.
Yeah.
I guess I started doing when I did A-level music.
Yeah.
School. I had a very good music teacher, Paul Foster. And he was quite an inspiring teacher, really. So he sort of encouraged that sort of analytical approach. And I guess I've always had that. I mean, I have that even when I'm improvising, free improvising. I've got a sort of a compositional thing working at the same time, like trying to make things happen.
Yeah.
You know. So, yeah, it was, I got a good, you get to see a lot of really good melodies and a lot of really good counterpoint and some interesting harmony. You also get to realise that all jazz harmony is stolen, simplified and systemized for consumption by people who like that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But that there's a lot of, there are a lot of other ways of going into harmony.
Yeah.
That was the thing that I realized doing that course, I think.
How long was that? 3 years that you were there?
Yeah.
And what did you do afterwards? Back to London?
I went to the Guildhall.
Ah, cool.
Did the postgrad. So I had Simon Purcell for piano teacher and Pete Churchill was there.
As a student?
Yeah, no, they were there as tutors.
Right.
But I guess they're not that much older than me. So it was probably quite new. I don't know how many years old, but probably I guess they'd been teaching 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
Maybe more. Yeah, and that was great. Plus it was the only thing around, so anything was great.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I spoke to Nick Smart yesterday, and he said that was the only postgrad at the time at Guildhall.
Yeah, and there weren't undergrads. Jazz undergrad was like, what's that? Why would you do a jazz undergrad?
Oh, wow.
So there you go, yeah. Yeah, I remember when, yeah, we used to sit in the road in a shoebox and eat blah, blah, blah. You know.
So who else were you studying with when you were at Guildhall?
Well, apart from Simon, who was sort of my main piano teacher,
who
was great because I was doing gigs and I could play and everything, but I had a lot of stuff down in F that I couldn't do in G flat.
Yeah.
And he was really good at making me sort everything out, you know, and not rely on flamboyant sort of creativity all the time and to actually work some stuff and get some things down,
right,
you know, and that was really useful.
Yeah.
And then I had a few lessons with John Taylor and that was fantastic.
Oh, cool.
My hero at the time.
Yeah.
And yeah, he was great. I mean, that was just like sort of sitting around chatting about Shostakovich and things like that, you know.
Yeah. And was anyone on the course as a student with you that's still playing now?
Yeah, Martin Hathaway was there. My mate Trevor Lyons, who lives in Birmingham now, who plays on a lot of different scenes up there, like folk and jazz and improvised music, all kinds of stuff.
Right.
Stacey Kent, Jim Tomlinson, they were both there.
Oh, cool.
Dave Blackmore. Actually, I don't know if he's still playing, but he I think he might be on the folk scene a bit more as well. I've sort of lost touch with a lot of these people.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a very mixed group of people, postgrads. It was like there were some people that were real serious, purist jazz kind of people. And then there are a lot of people that were sort of songwriters and kind of into a broader sort of thing.
Yeah.
McLaughlin. I don't know if you know Diane McLaughlin. He plays with Alison Rayner and Deidre Cartwright and them. She was on it.
No, I don't know her.
Yeah, a saxophone player.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. But I missed a lot of the people that I know well went a little bit earlier than me, like Phil Robson, Christine Tobin. Those kind of people were a couple of years before me, I think.
Right. And in Nick's interview, he talked about you guys hanging out loads after he'd finished Guildhall and listening to loads of albums.
Yeah.
He said that was quite a formative time for him. So he owes you one, I reckon.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was a weird time. I mean, I remember I used to practice the Bart Goldberg variations most of the time during the day. I sort of did a bit of teaching. I did a few gigs. I got drunk a lot.
Yeah.
To a lot of records. And it was a very sort of self-regarding time. You know, it's a formative time.
Yeah. When
you don't have other responsibilities. So you're kind of, I mean, to put it in a very cold sort of way, I think you're putting in data that then over the next however long your career is, you sort of process it a bit more and you do things and stuff comes out or you're reminded of albums that you used to listen to. But I certainly, that was an opportunity to listen to things in quite a deep way that I don't think I feel I have that opportunity anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, I maybe should make more time to do it, but it doesn't, it's not the first thing that occurs to me to do anymore, which is a shame in a way, but I just think that's the way it is. Your 20s are, in a way, when you're at college, it's difficult to keep pace with the information you're given. So you have to physically work that course out after you leave, I think.
Yeah, I totally agree with that.
And you know, the best advice I could give to anyone who's at college is take notes and keep them all.
Yeah.
You know, in whatever form, but make sure you keep all that information.
I have everything from my master's. I voice memoed everything on my iPhone.
Yeah.
But I would voice memo classes that I wasn't even a part of. I'd like take them into Pete Churchill, my phone, and be like, Pete, can I drop this here for a few hours? You know, and when I came back, he always had a mischievous little smirk on his face, like I knew he'd been messing with it.
That's good. And then, but then you're faced with the thing of, when do I listen? I mean, that's the other thing about now, obviously, the thing that everybody talks about all the time. I'm desperate to find something else to talk about, but actually the proliferation of music and the internet and everything is you've got to really work on yourself to focus on anything, to listen to anything.
Yeah.
To kind of remember what you've got. Like, I bought this Chris Speed record the other day on Bandcamp, and I just thought, I know what's going to happen somewhere. So I've made myself listen to it every day.
Yeah.
You know, and it's funny how you forget that with music, a lot of the time you've got to wait for things to reveal themselves. It's so frustrating that people only give you 10 seconds now.
Yeah.
They flick over onto something else. And, you know, that's just up to the individual. We just have to do that.
Yeah, I can't. I mean, we're really into buying CDs and then putting them in the car. And then it's easy to kind of listen over and over again and try and get a proper idea of each track and the whole shape of it. But I can't imagine being like a normal person, you know, just like 10 seconds of a track. Like, that kind of worries me deeply, that probably 99% of the people in the country, like, that's what music is to them, you know?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's like listening is like a sort of pre-listening thing. I mean, I might listen to 10 seconds or something and think, oh, it's that kind of thing. I think I need to sit down properly and listen to that.
Yeah.
Most people will think, oh, it's that kind of thing. What's next?
You know,
and then they'll say, oh, have you heard Paul Blanc? And they'll say, yeah, it's that kind of thing. It's like, and that's done, you know, for them. Which, I don't know, maybe something good will come out of that. I imagine John Zorn would make something good out of that, because he was always interested in this sort of limited attention span and things moving around, and you're talking to somebody on the phone and then you look out the window like I'm doing now, and you're talking, but you also can see somebody's telling their kid off on the street or whatever. and that's how people experience reality, and maybe music that lines up with that might draw people in more. But then this was in the late 80s, you know, so there was no internet.
Yeah.
And John Zorn, as far as I know, he doesn't really have websites, or, you know, there are websites selling CDs, but he hasn't adapted to the online platform content provider sort of bullshit.
Yeah.
Content provider is jeepers.
Yeah.
I don't know what to say about that. Content. About
the internet in general.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm just too old to do anything useful with it, you know.
Well, you have that amazing video on YouTube. What's it called? I'd even done some research on this. The one with Liam Paul Clavis.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Which one is that? Here we are. Ain't Nobody's Business.
Yeah, yeah, we're doing some duos and then I do a solo thing. And
that is an absolute beauty, that video.
Have you seen the one on improvisation? There's one called On Improvisation, which my partner Eleanor, she's a filmmaker.
Oh yeah, I see that.
You did that, but that's I think quite interesting because she's interested in the shot and the kind of the visual atmosphere of things, and it's quite slow moving, and I think that's sort of missing in jazz. Jazz musicians kind of want to appear exciting to people. They want to appear dynamic.
Yeah. So you
have fast moving things and clips and people talking and larking about and sort of going up to the camera and making a face and all this stuff. And
yeah.
And I think maybe that's, I mean, maybe it works. And some people are just like that, you know, and that's great. But I don't see that much in the opposite direction. And I know why, but it's a shame, I think.
Yeah.
It's a sort of, it's an interesting way to view it. I think if Miles Davis was around, he would do it like that.
Yeah.
You know. But, yeah.
I'm going to watch that when we're done here. I haven't actually seen it, but I just found it on my YouTube, you know, typing your name in. It's quite easy.
Oh, it's on YouTube. That's good. I thought for a minute it might only be on Vimeo, but...
Yeah, no, it is definitely. There's some really lovely stuff. Tell me about your duet with Paul Clarvis. How did it start?
Yeah, this is quite funny. Me and him, I met him... The first time I met him, I was still at the Guildhall, so 91.
Yeah.
And they had this composer, Moondog, come over and do a work.
I know that guy. I've played a piece of his called Paris.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, you guys play that on the album.
Yeah, and as a saxophone player, maybe you've played in the sort of band that I played in called London Saxophonic, it became.
That's the kind of thing it was. It was like 10 saxophones, like saxophone.
Yeah, yeah, and piano, yeah. Piano, bass and drums. Yeah. And Guildhall, I think what happened, the Guildhall thought that because he's an American composer and there's all these saxophones and piano bass drums, they thought it was a jazz thing. So they got a pianist from the jazz course, which was me, to do these gigs.
Yeah.
But actually, well, as you know, if you've played any of his stuff, it's like kind of weird Renaissance counterpoint in the style of a swing band.
Yeah.
I mean, it's quite bizarre. And he's quite an eccentric.
Yeah.
Was quite an eccentric guy. And we did these massive gigs in Germany to like 3,000 people. And I had to play solo piano pieces, which were actually very simple, but slightly awkward in that they looked like they would sound one way, but one or two notes were just in the wrong place.
You know, like yeah.
A weird place. And so Paul was doing that band. He was one of the percussionists. And a couple of years after that, I was getting pissed with him. I remember we were sitting around and he was talking about West Side Story. And we were saying, let's do a duo version of West Side Story with the whole overture and then just like sort of improvised jazz versions of the songs.
Yeah.
And then somehow it actually happened and we did it and we did some gigs.
Wow.
I played a piano reduction of the overture with him playing the drums from memory. Cause he did one of his first gigs was playing West Side Story in the West End.
Right.
So, yeah, so we started doing that and then we started doing gigs where we would do the first set was one continuous set of West Side Story. And the second set was bits and pieces of stuff that we just felt like playing.
Yeah.
Which then that second set became the stuff on Starry, Starry Night.
Oh, cool.
The album that we did.
I love that album. That's so beautiful.
Yeah, I really like that album as well. It's and we wanted to do an album, the West Side Story thing, but the copyright thing is absolutely brutal.
Right.
Like you can't do more than three tunes from the musical and you have to do things that are from the symphonic suites, you know. So it's a real pain in the ass.
Yeah, it's a shame it has to be so strict.
But I think there are ways around it, because Dave Grusin did a West Side Story album. But I think the way around it is, you know, laughing lettuce. A bit of money will pay your way.
Yes. Love that laughing lettuce.
Yeah, that's a Julian Siegel expression.
It's fantastic. I saw you and Paul play at the North London Tavern maybe like 8 years ago now.
Yeah.
Your duo, and it was so good. And I particularly enjoyed that you didn't have like a set list at all. You just sit and discuss what you wanted to play next after each tune. And sometimes he'd name something and you'd be like, how's that go? And he'd sing a bit and you'd play a bit. And then the tune would just like collapse into something incredible.
Yeah. I'm glad that came off well. Because at the time it was just like, we never rehearsed. We never got time to get together, really.
Yeah.
Busy guy, as you know.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, it's one of those nice things where we can always just get back together and play, and it always seems to work.
Yeah. You know?
And we did recently this stuff with Mark Lewandowski, the Fats Waller thing, Mark's own project.
Right.
And that was nice, getting a bass in there, and changes everything, of course. But
yeah,
it was a nice thing to do that.
Is that out? Is that an album?
Yeah, it's out. It's out. It was released in May, I think.
Oh, cool.
Yeah,
I have to check that out. What made you do the Brubeck project?
I don't remember having a sort of eureka moment about that. I just remember I was listening to the Dave Diggs Disney record, which one of my favourite jazz records ever. That,
right.
And I just thought, actually, Brubeck is one of those people that punters love, but musicians don't like him. Basically, musicians don't like him. Most musicians will say, oh, yeah, cool, he wrote The Duke and In Your Own Sweet Way, and then they'll play you the Miles Davis versions of them.
Yeah.
But I actually found that his way of improvising was very interesting to me. I mean, I understand people's objections to him. I understand that people think it doesn't swing, and I understand that, you know, people don't like the sort of sudden detours into sort of list that he seems to do.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of things that he does in improvising that I think are really, really interesting and really individual. And he's never given credit for it. I mean, nobody credits him. There's a couple of people like Anthony Braxton, who has this weird thing about Brubeck. But I don't know, Braxton's a bit of a perverse character. I don't really know what he feels his connection is to Brubeck. But yeah. I like that he likes something about him.
Yeah.
And I just thought, I sort of really like the way that he plays. That was the first impetus, and then I thought, okay, I'll do an album of his tunes. But actually, his tunes are quite a different proposition in a way. They're very carefully, beautifully written, very well structured, you know, voice leading and all that kind of stuff. It's very classical and very, very well crafted, you know.
Yeah.
And so I thought it would be fun to do something with it. Plus, I thought people will like it, you know.
Yeah.
A lot of jazz music happens because other musicians like it, because you get into something.
Yeah.
Into something that's quite deep below the bonnet, you know.
Yeah.
And I struggle with that. You know, I really want to do that, and I find it difficult to set out to be popular. But sometimes if you can hang it on something popular like Brubeck, but whilst having a genuine liking for it, then
yeah.
No, I thought, why not? It could be an interesting thing to do. You know, and Brubeck, I'd sent a copy to Brubeck himself while he was alive, and he really liked it. He sent me a really nice letter.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
you know, because I think he's, you know, I think he really was genuinely an experimental player. He did a lot of polytonal stuff, but he wanted people to like it.
Yeah.
You know, and that's as far as I go with him, you know. I mean, the whole social thing and the stuff about him being on the cover of Time and all this stuff about him being a white jazz musician. I mean, he's a pretty kind of, I don't know the history well enough to say that he actually did anything for musicians of color in the 50s, but he certainly went to a lot of southern states.
Yeah.
Had Gene Wright in the band as a bass player, and they played on the stage, and they got through a lot of protests and played anyway. And he refused to play if they wouldn't let Gene Wright stay in the same hotel and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah,
which seems now like, of course you would do that, but then at the time, I think a lot of people, I don't know what they would have done.
Yeah.
You know, it was a brave thing to do at that time.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. I just, it's when I put the records on, I like it. That's, yeah, it goes, you know.
That's it. What have you got planned in the near to mid future? Have you got anything on the horizon?
Yeah, I've got a gig coming up soon. It is September the 25th.
Oh, sweet.
And it's a double bill. Tom Hewson's playing solo, and I'm doing a trio with Seb Rochford and Tom Herbert. But I don't know what the hell we're going to do yet. I don't know if we're going to play tunes, if we're going to... And it's quite hard getting those two together to rehearse, you know.
Yeah. Where's the gig?
It's at the Cockpit Theatre. 25th of September.
Oh, lovely. That very conveniently is after this show will be aired.
Ah.
Which is incredible. So everyone, all the listeners. Right.
Oh, well, that's good.
Yes, we've just sold 200 tickets for that gig.
Yeah. There's a lot on Facebook when you say hope to see you all there. It's like, yeah, if you all come.
Yeah.
Oh, God. And people reading it here would be good.
Yeah. That would be so surreal if every last one of your Facebook friends showed up.
Yeah.
Like a massive jazz intervention.
God.
I know. Yeah. Do you have one pianist in particular that you would kind of cite as a huge influence musically?
I mean, there are big pillars of influence for me. You know, there's people that I go back to and listen to a bit because I love their playing, like Bud Powell, for instance.
Yeah.
A towering influence, but I love listening to it, and I love the sort of madness in his playing. I love the sort of manic quality that it has.
Yeah.
I mean, Ellington and Monk are the big ones, really.
Yeah.
But then, sort of next to them is Paul Blay and Keith Jarrett. You know, they're important.
Yeah.
I don't know the rest of it. Cecil Taylor is really important to me. God, there's a lot of people. There's a lot of the older players. I mean, Fats Waller. I love Willie the Lion Smith, Teddy Wilson. Brubeck, I already mentioned. Herbie is just sort of everywhere. You can't really even talk about him. He's like Herbie and Bill Evans are just in everything.
Herbie seems to have lived forever.
Yeah, yeah.
Sometimes I listen to like old Miles albums and I'm like, Jesus Christ, Herbie, like he's still going now. Like these albums, they feel to me like a really long time ago.
Yeah. Horace Silver, actually, he's another one I really like.
Mm.
And he's another one like Brubeck. People don't talk about him as a player, you know.
No, not so much, certainly.
Yeah, it's like great tunes. What are you talking about? I mean,
yeah,
moves like crazy.
There's an album I can't remember the name of with Mike and Randy Brecker when they're both really young, like a late 70s album that's really cool. That was my first Horace Silver experience, but I thought it was amazing.
Yeah.
Not good enough to remember the name of the album, though.
No, of course. But like, he, you know, got a thing where you can't really codify it. You know, what's he doing? There's a couple of voicings you can say, yeah, he uses that a lot, but that sort of plonky left hand thing he does, I mean, nobody really knows what that is. The same as Errol Garner, you know, it's like, what are they doing? How do you do it? It's no one's really managed to make sense of it.
Yeah.
Another person who's really important is Geri Allen. She was somebody who it was like finding an alternative to the big influences with everything.
Right.
You know, Jarrett was a massive influence, but then it got a bit saccharine for me with the Standards Trio. After a few albums, I could feel it's a bit, it's just emotionally not what I feel.
Right.
Like. So then I got into Paul Blay a bit more. That's a bit, he's a bit more abstract.
Yeah.
But Paul Blay doesn't always groove the way that I wanted to. And Geri Allen was kind of a midpoint with all these people.
Yeah.
I think. And she brought in a kind of African sort of thing, which compositionally especially, that opened a lot of doors for me, you know.
Oh, well, I don't know Geri Allen. I'm going to have to do some research.
Oh, yeah. Go back right to the beginning and work your way forward. Because I think most of her best stuff, or the formative stuff, was kind of 80s, 90s.
Yeah.
And she got a bit more like, she seemed to get in the shadow of Herbie a bit. And it was like a lot of the stuff sounded a lot more like him.
Yeah.
But having said that, even some of the later, I got an album after she died. I got this album with the tap dancer that she did, and that was really killing. You know, I mean, she was really an interesting musician.
Yeah, that's a hell of a set of people to go and research.
Yeah, that. And that's just piano players. I mean, there's a lot.
Yeah.
Mostly, I don't listen to piano players because it's. Oh God, I just don't want to get into voicings and all that stuff. I always feel slightly unhappy with my playing when I'm doing all of that voicing stuff. I can hear something else, and mostly it's from listening to horn players.
Yeah,
people, Bill Frisell, Sonny Rollins. You know, that kind of approach, that sort of rigorous approach to improvising.
Yeah.
Patient approach to improvising, you know. I'm sitting here looking at my CD collection and thinking, oh, yeah, Lester Bowie, really like Lester Bowie. He's not often talked about, and, you know, it's
yeah.
Just about see things sticking out. Eric Dolphy. It's, yeah. A wealth of stuff.
Are you still a CD buying guy?
I sometimes, yeah. Yeah, I must admit I'm erring more towards Bandcamp now. I'm sort of trying to find a way out of Apple altogether, but I don't know how, really. I don't know how I can do that.
Yeah.
I'm just like a junkie. I'm a sick junkie.
Yeah, well, you know, these things are all cyclical. I'm sure one day the empire will come crashing down.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, you're right. Quite a stranglehold. On that dark and terrifying note, Liam, thank you so much for coming on the Jazz Podcast.
It's been a pleasure.
Oh, man, it's been amazing.
Yeah, from the comfort of my own sofa.
What more could you want, eh? And now everyone can listen to it from the comfort of their own sofas.
Exactly.
Maybe I'll put a warning on the start of this show that an ideal position would be a sofa.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I think I'll do that.
Yeah.
Amazing. Well, yeah, thanks again. Thanks for coming on.
Well, thanks, Rob. Yeah, thank you for asking me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. We'll speak to you soon.
Great.
Awesome.
Right. Cheers. Thanks, thanks a lot.
Bye.
Bye.
So there you go. I hope you enjoyed episode 28 of the Jazz Podcast, where Rob had a lovely chat with Liam Noble. Next week, we are sitting down with, well, so we, Rob sat down with Sam Rapley, a great sax player who I was at Academy with. But he's sadly, he's nursing an injury to his wrists or arms or elbows or something like that. Was it skiing? I'm not sure. You'll find out next week if you come and listen on Friday. Rob has been piling out a lot more album previews, so I hope you're enjoying those. I think someone won that competition as well. Kenny Wheeler's first job, I don't even know. Rob, if you were here, I would ask you, what was his first job? Because I'm sure everyone is dying to know. I don't know if you... Have I just not listened to one of the album previews where you announced it? Maybe I missed that. Anyway, thanks so much, everyone, and have a great weekend, great day, hour. Enjoy your coffee, your drive, whatever you're up to. See you next time.